Supervise me.
Welcome to Super Science Me, Science and Fiction. This episode of Super Science Me is all about science fictional worlds. And this is Julia Grillmeier. In science fiction, more than in other genres, the plot, what actually happens, often is less important than the worlds in which they transport us. Worlds that consist of many planets, where various different conditions bring forth many different lifestyle of the humans or non-humans we encounter on them. Water planets, desert planets, planets with two suns and three moons. Planets populated by only women, by only men, or by entities that have no gender at all. By fungal networks without hierarchies, or by cruel alien warlords. Worlds we experience through the eyes of a tree, or a self-aware plastic bag, or a human sent to another timeline to report back what's going on, but it's too weird and ungraspable to put it into words. The design, the underlying ideas and philosophies of these worlds, and also how they are presented to the reader, all this and much more is meant by the term world building. What world building means, and what we, as science fiction readers, fans and scholars, do with these worlds, this was the topic of the conference Worlding SF in Graz. Organized by Stefan Rabitsch, Michael Fuchs and Stefan Brandt from the American Studies Department. In this episode of Super Science Me, you will hear some clips taken from presentations at the conference, as well as some interviews with the science fiction scholars I could meet there. This event was actually really great for me, because not only did I take a huge reading list back home, but it was a great opportunity to think about what these science fiction worlds actually do and what we do with them. Most of them play in the near future and thus almost automatically engage us in a reflection on how we would like this future to be. This counts for realist dystopias to the same extent as for completely weird worlds of wonderful tentacular slimy beings. As science fiction critics, fans, readers and researchers, the interesting question is if these worlds can help us to cope with some of our problems, if they open up new perspective to think things through, or if they provide us with escapist entertainment, already made ideologies, and if these aspects are actually really mutually exclusive or go together pretty well. What was also very interesting at the Worlding SF conference was the emphasis on who creates these worlds. Many talks at the conference have hinted at the fact that even though we have as many and as diverse science fiction worlds as ever before, many of them belong to huge corporations and are part of a highly commercial franchise market. There are actually so many aspects, books and topics here that it is really hard to find a starting point. So I'll just start with one of my personal highlights. Yes, let's stay a little bit longer with the tentacular ones and listen to a small part of Cheryl Morgan's really great keynote.
I should also start, as is becoming traditional, with some content warnings. This is a presentation about issues of sex and gender. There will be talk of boobs and penises and copulation and all that sort of stuff. The other content warning is that I will be talking about the mating habits of spiders and similar creatures. If there are any gentlemen of a nervous disposition in the audience, you too may want to leave.
Cheryl Morgan talked about systems of sex and gender.
I want to start just by thinking that, you know, in science fiction we have a lot of aliens, a lot of different creatures, and in fantasy as well, of course. And a lot of the time, for reasons of budget and for needing to use actors rather than CGI, we do tend to make them look rather like humans with lumps on their heads. But we do tend to go rather more than that. I've started with this picture of a Khajiit from Skyrim. They are cat people. And when I see pictures of that, there's just one thing that comes into my mind, and that is, why has she got boobs? Right? Female cats do not have breasts, and they have more than two nipples. So there's something strange going on. And maybe the Khajiit have evolved to have breasts and only two nipples. But in that case, maybe there ought to be an explanation, because that's what we do in science fiction, isn't it? We have an explanation as to why the world has diverged from what we know. So what is the evolutionary reason why cat women always seem to have boobs just like humans? Now this, of course, is Madame Vastra from Doctor Who. She is a lizard woman. And she also has boobs, which is weird because lizards lay eggs. What does she need them for, exactly? I think we can do better. The trouble is that as humans and as people brought up in experience of a largely heteronormative, cisnormative society, we have this dreadful tendency to impose our ideas of heteronormativity and nuclear families and whatever on the entire animal kingdom. As you know, shown by Noah's Ark, where all of the animals go in two by two. There's a mummy animal, a daddy animal, and the expectation that they're going to produce baby animals after the flood is over.
Before hearing this keynote by Cheryl Morgan, I actually managed to interview her in a shirt that has a embroidery on it showing Noah's Ark. You will hear the conversation in a minute, but I'll have to play you another snippet of her keynote for obvious super scientific reasons.
Now, it wouldn't be a proper science fiction talk without squid in it. So, here is a squid. Now, the arrow squid is up there because arrow squids have three genders. There's a female gender, which is undifferentiated, and there are two types of males. There are macho males, who are all about territory and getting hold of the girls and whatever, and then there's a more cunning species, or a cunning gender of male arrow squid, who aren't so much about territory and domination. They're all about being quick and getting in there and getting the girl and running away again before one of the macho ones catches them. Those are very distinct genders within arrow squid society, and many types of fish do that sort of thing.
For all listeners who can understand German, we have three tentacular episodes in our Super Science Me archive. And actually, it's an ongoing engagement. But now please listen to me talking to Cheryl Morgan, who was so kind to give us an interview.
I think there's quite a lot of interesting gender stuff happening at this conference, which is always heartwarming. And we're starting now to see a little bit of concentration on science fiction created outside of the white Anglocentric world, which is also a very good thing. But as to what is topical now in science fiction, you know, I mean, I think people ought to be talking about climate change because we really need to talk more about it.
This brings us also to your keynote, and it's entitled Systems of Sex and Gender. Could you speak about how science fiction could maybe help us imagine and also speak and maybe ultimately also act non-binary and non-heteronormative?
Well, interestingly, Julia, I see that you're wearing a shirt that is embroidered with images of Noah's Ark. And the story of Noah's Ark, as we're taught it, is a very heteronormative, cisnormative, nuclear family type thing, that you have Noah and his wife and you have each of the animals, and it's a male and a female, and they're going to start families together. And that is our view of the world based on a particular set of social structures which happen to be common in Western Europe and its colonies over the past couple of hundred years. And people keep saying that that is natural and that anything else is unnatural. But if you look at the animal world, you see that their family structures are all over the place. You have
gay animals, you have transgender animals, you have polygamous animals. The natural world does almost everything except what we tell it is supposedly natural. And from that point of view, clearly there's a message for us that these things that we pretend are natural are not really natural at all.
And in science fiction, this becomes specifically visible.
Well, it can do. The problem that I'm going to address in my talk is that when we do science fiction, we quite often project our existing heteronormative, cisnormative nuclear family ideas onto every alien species that we write into our stories. Now, part of that, of course, is because if you're doing film and television, you have a limited budget. And that's why aliens tend to end up looking like humans with lumps on their heads rather than anything particularly alien. But in fact, if you're writing a book, you could imagine aliens in all sorts of different ways. And you can look to the natural world on this planet for inspiration to do that.
Do you have maybe a book recommendation that you liked and that is particularly doing that?
Well, there are a number of books that address that. I guess a reasonably topical example would be the books of the Raksura by Martha Wells. Now, Martha has become justifiably famous because of the Murderbot stories, but the Raksura series was what she did before that, and I was really impressed by that because she has in it an alien race which has family systems and gender systems that are very, very different from our own. And there aren't that many science fiction writers that do that sort of thing.
Of course, I had to ask also about the tentacular ones.
Well, the whole thing about tentacles has a long and complicated history. I mean, on the one hand, you have H.P. Lovecraft and his horror of anything with tentacles. And I think people have seen how ridiculous that was. And they've become quite fond of dear old Cthulhu and all of the other tentacled beings from beyond the stars. So that's one side of the tentacled monsters thing. Then, of course, you have Margaret Atwood's famous comment that science fiction is about talking squid in space. And ever since she said that, everybody wants to put talking squid in their book just to wind her up. But also, of course, the common octopus is one of the most intelligent species on the planet. And if we are going to find an alien species that we can interact with, something that is as intelligent as an octopus and is as different from us as an octopus, is a very good example.
So let's right away come to some science fiction worlds that do a better job of imagining aliens. Found in the Wording SF panel entitled The Post, Trans and Non-Human Worlds. Here Aparashita Nanda talked about Octavia Butler's work, especially her Xenogenesis trilogy.
So Butler's trilogy proposes an antidote for the dogmatic human attitudes that prognosticate complete destruction of the human species. Her text opens in the wake of a human-led nuclear apocalypse, where the few surviving humans are rescued by the Oankali, an animal-like gene-trading alien species, who intend to interbreed with the humans to create a superior breed of human Oankali constructs.
Octavia Butler's wonderful novel, Dawn, the first novel of her Xenogenesis trilogy. The alien race Oankali here saves humankind from its own atomic apocalypse, but not within some individualistic heroism, but with the intent to breed a new alien race together. This is how the Oankali evolve. Aparashita Nanda showed how this can be related to Hinduism.
The Oankali justify their mission by stating that the humans need to be rid of their contradiction, and the contradiction is combination of intelligence and hierarchical thinking, and accept a genetic elimination of the violent trait to produce a sustainable creolized third identity. Now, this third identity, a product of the human-animal interface, birthed of human intelligence and alien-animal connectivity to all species, because you see, these Oankali interbreed with all living beings, questions the established boundaries of the human-animal divide And this paper reads these Butlerian creolized identities based off Hinduism and some of its seminal texts, the Vedas, the Puranas, and the Upanishads.
Also in the post-trans non-human panel, Miriam Köbel talked about the strategy game Alpha Centauri, where the player colonizes an exoplanet. But the planet has a mind of its own that invades the human mind. But first of all, listen to her nice and refreshing resume of some major point of critical post-humanism.
However, evidence suggests that humans are perhaps not actually all that special. The sun does not revolve around the Earth. Our solar system is not the center of the galaxy. Our galaxy is not the center of the universe. We are not distinct in kind from animals. I mean, evolution links us to them, and many of our supposedly uniquely human qualities like empathy, reasoning, tool use, well, they're not actually so unique to us either.
In the game Alpha Centauri, human exceptionalism is further challenged when the fungal network, that is the consciousness of the planet, starts to interact with the human through some sort of telepathy.
The player character does not initially welcome these intrusions, find them unnerving and inconvenient, unsure where the contact is real or where they are simply losing their mind. Humans explore and colonize the planet, but at the same time, the fungal network explores human minds, neither seeking permission beforehand. When communicating with the humans, the planet does say it will take them in, but it fears it will suffer a similar fate to Earth.
So the fungi is ready to take the humans in, but fears at the same time they will mess up the planet like they did with planet Earth. The environmental crisis and science fiction. How science fiction here provides either inspiration how to act, or escapism to not think about it at all, or to believe in some technological fix or exoplanet escape plan that will save humanity eventually, these topics concern Jerry Canavan. He also held a great keynote at the conference Wilding SF, and I had the opportunity to talk to him and ask him first of all what world building in this context means.
Sometimes it's the background details of these stories that stick with you more than the plots. And in some sense, the plots oftentimes are very generic, right? They involve the same kinds of things happening in the same kinds of spaces to the same kind of characters over and over and over again. And you find yourself in the classroom or in a paper just kind of really obsessed with like this one weird thing about how money is supposed to work in this space, or this weird thing they breathe, or this weird thing they do when they go to sleep. And so you wind up kind of fascinated by these background details. And I've always been struck by the idea that science fiction actually weirdly kind of functions like a mystery novel, where you're trying to parse out the details of the background world. And then when you do, and you kind of become the master of the space, suddenly the story becomes solved in a way, right? And it's always seemed to me that a little bit, that's why a lot of these novels and films have endings that we're dissatisfied with, because we misunderstand what we were really invested in. It wasn't the plot, but it was kind of penetrating this kind of other world and exploring it. And once we've seen it all, then we don't really care that much how they blow up the bad robot.
Well, that's really interesting, because it's another aspect of what has actually repeatedly said at this conference, in my observation, that this world building then also refers back, of course, to the real world and this almost also political then reference to this world makes possible. So the potential of social criticism. So is this also something you're interested in?
I absolutely think that that's a lot of what draws us to. I mean, it's kind of an old style intervention in science fiction studies at this point, but the centrality of kind of utopian formulation and our desire for like a vision of difference other than the world that is making us so unhappy seems to be so much of what animates us to these other kinds of fantastic and speculative worlds. With, you know, good and bad consequences, sometimes the vision of utopia is really good, and other times it's kind of training us to think in bad ways about what's possible or about other people, right? So there's always this kind of moment of self-critique about the utopia we think we're consuming.
And this brings me also to your topic. Specifically, you will talk at this conference about climate fiction. Mm-hmm. And if I understood right, also about this notion of crisis. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about this a little bit more?
Right. So, I mean, you know, in some sense, the story of science fiction is the same story of 20th century modernity, there's this long period where anything seems possible. We seem on the cusp of some kind of incredible transcendent transformation that will free us all. And then somewhere in the 60s and 70s, we kind of have a simultaneous realization that there's actually nothing out there in space for us. It's incredibly difficult to live there. It's incredibly difficult to even go there. There's no real reason to, right? Once we get to the moon, we're bored with it after 3 years. And then alongside that revelation that there's nowhere to go in outer space, we realize that we're kind of destroying the planet, right? Through the kind of emergence of the ecological movement. And so to me, almost everything that's happened since the 70s in mainstream culture, as well as in science fiction, has to do with this kind of like, almost like nauseous realization that the future isn't good. Like it isn't what we thought it was going to be. And that instead is this kind of source of threat. And in the contemporary moment, that's so tightly linked to climate change and this kind of ongoing inability to face up to the reality of what's happened. I mean, I'm about to turn 40 and you can see the difference in winters from when I was a child, right? People can make jokes about climate change all they want, but California wasn't on fire all the time when I was a child, right? The level of disaster, cities weren't being flooded and having to be evacuated all the time, right? Like, the things we are seeing are a kind of bleeding edge of something horrible, right, that we can't face up to. And so what I'm interested in some sense, is the way both science fiction and other kind of forms of culture are or aren't kind of facing up to the reality of what's emerging in the world.
So here, once again, this world building mm-hmm. in science fiction can then maybe help us also to understand mm-hmm. what's happening around us, maybe also give us hints how to mm-hmm. act.
Yeah, it can, but it has to be done well, right? Because so commonly in science fiction, the imagination is, and then they invented like the Juniper process, which means that you don't have to worry about emissions and energy is just free and there's no problem anymore, right? Or they invent something that can eat toxic waste, right? So everything is fine, right? And so those kinds of fantasies are like kind of increasingly strained, right? And what actually we seem to need is some kind of realistic accounting of where things come from and where they go. And so I'm very interested in stories that kind of do that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Something also that interests me a lot, this idea of futurism, but without being escapist. Mm-hmm. And this becomes very clear when escapism means to really escape from planet Earth. Or here this becomes really visible. Mm-hmm. Do you have maybe just to wrap it up, some book recommendations or film recommendations, mm-hmm. something you think that does this well?
One of my favorite authors for this, contemporary authors for this, is Kim Stanley Robinson. And so the novel I'm going to talk about at my keynote is New York 2140, which takes place in a flooded Manhattan in 2140, where people are using zip lines and gondolas to travel the city. They're parking their boats at the bottom of what used to be skyscrapers. And it's this kind of fascinating vision of this squatter's paradise that emerges once all the rich people evacuate New York and move to Denver, and this kind of new community that emerges. Part of what I like so much about Robinson's work is that he's always kind of looking for the kind of utopian reversal that could emerge. So like, even after the worst has happened and, you know, liberal society has effectively collapsed for 100 years, there's still a possibility for something better to emerge, like if we seize the opportunity. And so I like that about him.
The great clumping foot of nerdism stamping on the human face forever. This was the title of Mark Bolt's keynote at Worlding SF. Explanatory subtitle, World Building and Contradiction. He was so kind to talk to us and give us further insight in his research on science fiction. And we start once again with the question of what world building means and does.
I think all science fiction fantasy texts rely on some kind of world building, and that the nature of that world building changes over time and depending on context. So at the moment, there's a real drive to produce and a fascination in consuming worlds that seem full and populated. So you think about things like the Marvel Cinematic Universe extensions of Star Wars and so on. This idea that we can create a fictional universe in which we can immerse ourselves in a way that parallels our immersion in the real world. And I think that's become the contemporary site for all kinds of things, including thinking about the virtual and what it means to, what immersion means, what being in the world means, and how you can use fiction to think about the real world.
To think about the real world in these imaginary worlds, this is also something that has been stressed repeatedly at this conference. And of course, that brings us to the question of how these words are constructed. And it's important how these words are constructed when we think about it through this lens about our lives. So this is also a point you made at your keynote, and you criticized specifically a kind of streamlinedness of these words. Can you go into detail about this?
Yeah, I think there's a misconception that goes on around massive story worlds, that they're full of detail and that they're coherent and they make sense. And obviously, if you're the owner of the intellectual property, you want to be able to tie everything down so you can own it. But the world is messier than that. And just the complexity of texts makes fictional worlds much messier than that. And I think that gulf between the image of a coherent, unified world, whether it's fictional or the real world, and then our actual experience of the messiness of the real world or the fictional world, is a place to prize open a text, prize open our experience, and begin to ask questions about dominant ideologies, how they're reproduced, how they shape our perception of textual worlds and the real world. You know, just creating that moment where people realize the fictional world is fictional and hopefully turn around and realize how ideologically constructed what seems to be the real world is. But I think also we can use fictional worlds to highlight power structures in the real world and do that quite deliberately. So Frederick Jameson, a long time ago, spoke about science fiction texts as using what he calls world reduction, where you can't create an entire world and you select the features to make prominent in a fictional world. And those features are very easy in science fiction and fantasy to organize around the way gender and sexuality and race are treated. And I think then the important contradiction that emerges is the contradiction between the fictional world and the real world. And hopefully that's a space for thinking and for political praxis to emerge.
Yeah, besides this construction of worlds in relation to the real world in terms of topics and style, you have already mentioned also the production context that comes repeatedly into play also in this conference to show, okay, we have these various world building storytelling lines, but they come from major huge corporations. Are there other aspects that you see in this conference program reoccurring that you say these are the very important questions to ask right now in the context of science fiction research?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting work going on around gender and Afrofuturism here. But the other one I'd flag up is the Petracultures session that's happening later today, and the ways in which science fiction and fantasy are helping us think about climate change and reconceptualize what the Anthropocene is and how limited and finite human existence is and the sheer urgency of the current moment. And science fiction isn't the only way to deal with the Anthropocene by any means, but it has a special tool set that can link world building, scientific research, scientific facts, scientific discovery with lively characters and stories and hopefulness and optimism. With climate fiction, it's very easy to get depressed very, very quickly. There are ways that science fiction and fantasy offer hope. The worst kind is probably where it's an individual savior figure who comes up with some magical technology. And that's, you know, you understand why people might find that comforting. But the exciting stuff is going on with the, you know, development of experimental technologies, thinking about changing energy structures, thinking about different kinds of social life and being that the world we're currently creating will require of us in the future if we're to survive.
So again, once again, political and social criticism in science fiction.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very easily missed if if all you're seeing is the rocket ships and the robots, which are cool and do need to be there and are thoroughly enjoyable. But science fiction is about so much more than just being that Buck Rogers stuff.
How science fictional worlds could help us to make sense of our current situation was of concern for a lot of talks at the Worlding SF conference. So also for Lars Schmeink. He talked about cyberpunk and how it could raise awareness of social inequalities in an increasingly capitalist world where everything is commodified. Science fiction can make accessible changes so drastic and big that we are overwhelmed and thus blinded by them.
I mean, a good example of this is, of course, 2 degrees of global warming will have all been warned, will have massive effects on weather patterns, flattening over like an average 9% more intensity of rainfall than storms. But only the science fictional imagination is able to package this so that it hits home. Geostorm, The Day After Tomorrow, and other films are kind of drastic representations of climate effects. So my contention then is that the SF imagination is an indicator of both the challenges that we will face and the solutions that might be possible.
Lars Schmeink took the series Sleep Dealer and Altered Carbon as examples of how science fiction depicts the commodification of bodies. We hear a snippet of his talk, and here he cites the science fiction scholar Cheryl Wind.
As Wind has pointed out, capitalism expands to fill all previously non-commodified spaces in private life, and in this case even placing the human body under what Stephen Shapiro has called real subsumption, which he defines as everything without exception is subordinated to an economic logic and economic rationality. Everything must be measured and made commensurable through the meditation of some sort of universal equivalent, money or information. So any and all objects, processes and goals are placed within this framework of economics. And a cyberpunk show such as Altered Carbon thus directly relates to real subsumption and provides the ideal imagery for this exterminist reality. Bodies literally become the object that we can trade, share, buy, or just discard if we don't need them anymore.
Not cyber, but steampunk was Pascal Lemaire's topic. And a very special strand of steampunk also. Steam Rome. The stories he looked at either play in ancient Rome, but have cars and all kind of other technology, or they play in the now, but with a Roman societal structure and ancient Roman motifs. In the case of the former, these stories differ in how technology is introduced in antiquity. We hear a little snippet from his talk.
One of the earliest ones is, of course, a time travel, bringing new technologies. Famous example from the early 40s, Les Dark and Fall by Lyon Sprague Dupin, which actually inspired a number of authors later on, and in which he sends an archaeologist from a World War II period back in time to the 6th century AD, at the time of the Byzantine invasion of Italy. Another series of books are two by John Maddox Roberts, in which technology is indigenous. In this story, Hannibal defeated the Romans and expelled them from Italy, and they make a comeback a few decades later and will join with the Egyptians and so gain access to the library of Alexandria, where they put their engineering mind, devising new machines thanks to the expertise of the library.
So either a time traveler or the Library of Alexandrina is the key for ancient Rome to come to technology. At a nice but very noisy evening event of Worlding SF, I found three Star Trek scholars who kindly agreed to shout over the noise and tell me about their research.
So I'm here with almost the whole Star Trek panel. There was a lot of Star Trek at this science fiction conference. Why Star Trek?
Because it's one of the most well-known shows and also one of the longest running, because we have several installments of that, and because Discovery is new, so we did Discovery.
This is Jenny Folkmer.
Yeah, we focus on Discovery because we're editing a book about it and we're nerds. So.
This is Sabrina Mittermeier.
And we've really been obsessed about Discovery. Most of us have watched Star Trek since we were kids or teenagers, and it's been a joy. It really has.
This is Marijke Spajala.
And at the conference is called Worlding, kind of related to world building. In what way does Star Trek is interesting in this sense? Is it also because of the serialization that you can come back to this world again and again?
Yeah, I think it definitely creates its own world. I mean, it's utopian in the way, oh, we've overcome poverty and we've overcome all these things. But as we also kind of discussed in the panel, you can never take the present or the actual production context out of it. But I think the world it builds is very interesting in terms of, you know, we have this world now where we all get along, at least with the humans, and we go places and explore. At least that's the original idea of Star Trek. And of course, it's usually complicated. And it's also much complicated in Discovery because there it's actually about war and a lot of other things.
But I think it's also interesting because you can, with every iteration, you see how the world is developed further and how they go back to some parts and refer back to that, but also update it, be that by updating the look or by adding things, adding to our knowledge about species that we've seen before or parallel universes that we've seen before. So it's a very, in a way, a very dynamic franchise, even though, or maybe because it's been around for over 50 years by now.
I think also that Star Trek is an interesting case because not only has it been around for so long, but because it has an established fan base and they always expect a certain thing or certain things. And if you compare it with, let's say, like trash TV or like self-produced things, we expect a higher level of world building, essentially, because if we know, for example, Doctor Who, when it started out, we know they didn't have a lot of money. They just did something and threw some things together, so it was fine. But from now, we expect a lot of it because it's American. They have money. They have an established fan base. They don't have to generate an audience. They already have a built-in audience. So we expect more of it, and I think that also plays into it.
So you all focus on Discovery. What aspects are most interesting for you?
I mean, in terms of what we're writing on right now academically, Jenny and I are writing an essay on masculinities, specifically the characters of Gabriel Lorca and Ash Tyler, and Mandaika and I are also writing together on queer representation on the show because it's the first Trek show that actually has an out gay couple in its main cast. And it will probably have more queer characters in the future that at least has been hinted at. So I think those are the most important aspects, at least for me right now. But as a fan, there's a ton more, but those are the academic aspects that I'm looking at.
The other paper I'm writing is on femininity gender in Discovery and what they do different in terms of representing female characters.
You're listening to Super Science Me, and today it's all about world building, because we have been at the Worlding SF science fiction conference in Graz. And there we met also Super Science Me habitué, Super Science Me all-star, Magdalena Hangl. She talked about sexualized violence in science fiction. You know that is her speciality from our very, very first episode. On the conference, she focused especially on the writer Ursula K. Le Guin.
All sexualized violence is reported from a male perspective. Aggressors are always male. The victims or survivors are always female. There's no rape, sexual violence where there is no gender or a non-violent society. Phase 3 has a very different approach to sexualized violence, as it will now show.
This is Magdalena Hangl talking about Le Guin's second phase of writing in the late 60s, early 70s, comprising the novels The Left Hand of Darkness, The Word for World is Forest, and The Dispossessed. Phase 3 consists of, for example, The Matter of Segri and A Woman's Liberation, two texts from the 1990s.
Especially in A Woman's Liberation, rape is suddenly a main topic and treated very differently. It seems like along the anti-rape movement of the 70s, the novels or the author as well grew in the perspective on sexualized violence. Survivors can be male or female, perpetrators can also be male and female, but there's still a gender binary here. And the perspective of the novels changed, of the stories changed. Now, like in A Woman's Liberation, the focus is on women and survivors, and also in The Woman's Liberation, for the first time, rape is a major topic of one story.
The probably most widely known text of Ursula K. Le Guin is The Left Hand of Darkness, where she imagines the planet Winter and the society of the Githenians. The Githenians are androgynous humans who only assumed a defined sex in their mating phase, where two individuals come together and without being able to choose who is going to be what, one becomes the receiving sex and will be pregnant if wish, and the other becomes the giving sex, producing semen. Elizabeth Shipley based a classroom experience exactly on this idea of a heterogeneous society. Besides The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin, she also considered Anne Leckie's books about a post-human identity inhabiting a spaceship and other technological bodies. Elizabeth Shipley now explains the classroom experiment.
The classroom experiment was inspired by Le Guin's and Leckie's experiments with gender, and it was an inspiration for the EFL classroom for both reading gender as well as for looking at our concepts of gender. In Leckie's space opera, the various languages of the various worlds coming together reflect and relativize gender perspective by contrasting linguistic conventions against one another, a fitting metaphor for the study of foreign language, showcasing how gender is performed differently in different languages and how the contrast brings unexpected insights and unsettles knowledge. Okay, so in an article called Doing and Undoing Gender in the Classroom, Helena Decacorno made some practical suggestions, one being for raising gender awareness, one being setting gender traps. And it is working with the gender traps that we tried to do with this creative writing project. And the schools involved were a 12th grade imaginative writing group at Fort Worth Country Day School, and a first semester language skills group at Karlsruhe University of Education, which I taught. And gender masking took place by giving students gender-neutral names, like Robin, or non-humanoid names like River or Wind or Ice. And then the students had 5 days to participate in a collaborative narrative of science fiction, introduce their fantasy character, and not use any gendered pronouns or gendered nouns. And they could interact with the other characters to whatever degree they wanted. It's produced a somewhat chaotic plot, but that was not our it was not our intention to produce a polished narrative, but it was a narrative of spontaneity. And the stories then tempted conventional gendered readings. For example, with professions like assassins, innkeepers, darkeeps, or wizards. And in addition, when love was the theme, it became particularly difficult to avoid gendered pronouns.
So Elizabeth Shipley's classroom experiment was not about writing a coherent story, but about reflecting on how much gender and gender politics are always present in our language. Another presentation took inspiration from Ursula K. Le Guin and especially from her novel The Dispossessed, which contrasts a capitalist society on Earth and an anarchist enclave that has been established on the moon. Amy Butt talked about The Dispossessed and architecture.
As noted by Graham, the vision of the high-rise urban future has become almost ubiquitous, in a closing off of alternative images which also denies the futures they contain. This pervasive vision becomes as inescapable as capitalism and conditions us to consider the future as synonymous with rapid vertical urbanisation. To step outside this canon is to revel in alternatives, architecture which is not as vast as empires but is as plain as spilled salt.
Amy Butt developed this imagery of the spilled salt in a highly poetic and interesting argument. You will hear her conclusion on architecture and Ursula K. Le Guin's novel The Dispossessed.
A city like spilled salt would be modest, unassuming, as plain as spilled salt. The salt lies glinting on the tabletop as it catches the light. Look closer at a single grain and see a tiny crystal hard and bright. A crystal formed from pools filled with ocean spray, slowly evaporating off hot earth. A distillation from our primeval homes. Salt is the complexity of history boiled down to single points of white. Salt is utility. A city like spilt salt would be refined, functional, no more or less. Frederick Jameson talks about Le Guin's narrative process of world reduction in The Dispossessed, a simplification which acts as a precondition for us to be able to imagine inhabiting a world without capital. The world which is depicted is sparse in both its narrative and architectural form, stripped back to only what is necessary for survival. In this harsh environment, we would not waste the carefully cultivated timber of the holm tree on construction, or the metals which must be exported to Arras in vital exchange. So we are left only with the stone and mud for the bricks, a technologically advanced civilization which chooses to use building materials familiar to the hands of our ancestors. Throughout all of this, the planet of Arras has hovered behind me, the capitalist counterpoint to Anaras' anarcho-communism, replete with overwhelming shopping streets and alienating tinted glazing. Here architecture is both art and product, as ornate as a Fabergé egg, exuberant in aesthetic delight, and heavy with the encrusted symbols of wealth. I must acknowledge that the slick renders of upcoming developments on hoardings around building sites in London, the visions of our urban future which we are being sold, would be at home alongside the architecture on the planet Arras. So the architecture of Anaras and Arras presents us with urban extremes. They ask me as an architect to make a moral decision about which I want my work to tend towards. I am asked if I would give up architecture as art, if it meant that architecture could never be co-opted as commodity.
I also had the opportunity to talk at this conference and actually was in a really great panel because we all fit very well together. It was called Science Fiction Becoming Real or Becoming Reality. I talked about how science fiction literature and the writing of scenarios in a more futurological context relate to each other. If you're interested in this, please check out my website. My project is called Science Fiction, Fact and Forecast and is at the University of Art and Design in Linz. And so my website goes sci-fi-fa-fo.com. sci-fi-fa-fo.com. But here I want to play you something from the presentations of my fellow speakers, Rodri Davis and Miranda Iosifidis. Rodri Davis talked about Scientology, the religion or sect, based on science fictional texts of L. Ron Hubbard. And he immediately captured the full attention of the room with a dramatic reading from Ron Hubbard's Have You Lived Before This Life?
This took place 9 galaxy periods ago. I was a male born of space parents. I seem to have had 2 or 3 mothers who died or were killed. At the age of 5, I was already on the lookout for brothels. At 15, I went with other boys and girls for 3 months to learn all about sex and homosexuality. When I was 16, I killed my father while fighting on the planet, and I joined a spaceship. There was homosexuality, as only officers were allowed women. I did not care for homosexuality and soon gained the title of captain, so was able to have a wife of my own. She had a baby, and a few days later I found the wife enjoying pleasures with another officer. I put her and the officer up for trial, and they were condemned and burned, zapped with special ray equipment. And I find this an intriguing passage, not least because how can a self-constructed, obviously imaginative narrative like this have any claim to truth or veracity? How can, for the individual who recounted this, this have become real?
Rodri Davis showed that the authority of Scientology had or has to do with the authority of science fiction.
Now, one of the ways in which these science fictional narratives accrue meta-representational authority, in my argument, is to do with the authority of science fiction as a discourse. And I'm focusing principally here on American pulp science fiction, the chief architects of whom, I would argue for the purposes of time constraints, Hugo Gernsback and John W. Campbell, Jr. Hugo Gernsback, role as an architect of the genre is well documented. He's very keen on using it as a means of promoting scientific knowledge, as a sort of pedagogic tool, in essence. And his texts, published in organs such as Wonder Stories, are characterized by these vast, clunky info dumps, where one character will basically explain the technology that's being witnessed to some kind of dumb klutz who knows nothing about it. And this is the means by which Gernsback can sort of impart his scientific principles.
Miranda Iosifidis showed another aspect of how science fiction relates to the world. She looks at how reading group exchange over science fiction books and what motivation they share.
So reading is critical and transformative, and ethical engagement a political act. It's not only about being able to radically reimagine the present in a critical way, but its powers are more everyday and mundane than that, more rooted in biography, personal experience, and reading contexts. One thing that all the groups care about is collective making sense of the futures in these books, in what way they're plausible and what they would do in these situations. There's a generosity between them that protects the discussion, and multivocality is important to them. This is what challenges individual members' pre-held notions and allows the possibility of new epiphanies about both literature and life, Elizabeth Long argues, who's done some work on reading groups.
Miranda Yusufidis especially analyzed reading groups that read Octavia Butler's The Parable of the Sower and The Parable of the Talents, as well as Jeff Vandermeer's Annihilation.
How do we create community in a way that's open to disagreement and sustains all the people within it? So I think that the fact that both of these authors are offering different ways of intervening in the present moment is quite fascinating.
Super interesting was furthermore the panel Greening Science Fiction. It was more about the genre New Weird than about science fiction proper, which I loved. Beate Gubacci talked about global weirding.
Global weirding is an embodiment of what Eugene Thacker calls the horror of philosophy, a realization of our limited understanding and the possibilities beyond, and an attempt to demarginalize and normalize otherness, an exploration of sustainable epistemologies and ontologies with less constraints.
Beate Gubacci showed how new weird fiction and critical posthumanism come together. She especially focused on the already mentioned Southern Reach trilogy by Jeff Vandermeer. If you haven't read the books yet, this would be Annihilation, Authority and Acceptance. This is an explicit recommendation.
New Weird is taking steps in this direction by actively experimenting with extending subjectivity and agency to the non-human, and this is apparent in its world-building strategies.
Also, Patricia Sokolowska talked about the new weird genre, but not about books, but the video game Dishonored.
Dishonored contains elements of science fiction, fantasy, as well as supernatural elements. Weird fiction features the weirding of life done in ways not easily classified and oftentimes stemming from the author's metaphoric preferences. It usually also features, however, cosmic horror and aspects of the sublime, both of which are present in the game.
In the same panel, Sarah Lohmann talked about A Utopia Without Us, ecofeminism, the Anthropocene, and the paradox of the non-human utopia. And this was another round of really good book tips. She read Le Guin's Utopia, Dancing at the End of the World. She read Joanna Russ' The Female Man and Joanne Sluchemsky's A Door into Ocean.
As our second example of ethical anthropocentrism in seemingly holistic complex utopias, Sluchemsky's A Door into Ocean likewise seems to tick all the boxes of networked, egalitarian interspecies coexistence. The amethyst-colored women named sharers who inhabit the post-apocalyptic ocean planet of Shora are deeply pacifist, self-organized through regular gatherings in a non-hierarchical fashion, and live in close reciprocal relationships with creatures such as the rocket squid, whose energy they harness for travel, the finger shells, which they spread to keep seaweed growth in check, and in a seemingly textbook example of entangled empathy, the breath microbes, who even allow them to breathe underwater and give their skin its characteristic color. As Wolf points out, this facilitates an ethics based not on ability, agency, and empowerment, but on a compassion that is rooted in vulnerability and passivity.
This Super Science Me episode started with tentacles, and it ends on tentacles. We have to stop here. This was a wild ride through only a small part of the huge variety of topics that were addressed at the conference Worlding SF in Graz. If you want to look up some details in the show note to this episode, you will find the link to the conference website,
where there's the program and abstracts of all the presentations. Also go on Twitter and use the hashtag WorldingSF to find hundreds of tweets on this event, many of them service tweets providing reading recommendations and further infos. I want to thank the conference organizers for their support and also the team of the Grazer Kunstkessel who did the social media coverage of WorldingSF, and we did all the interviews together. On the Facebook page of WorldingSF, you can find their videos and pictures, and also the keynotes can be watched there. More science fiction content you can find on the Super Science Me podcast feed, for instance our cyberpunk snippets. All episodes we have recorded so far you find of course in the cultural broadcast archive of the free radios in Austria. Also follow Super Science Me on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, and if you are in Vienna, tune in every second Tuesday of the month, 6 p.m. Radio Orange. The next Super Science Me episode will air in 2019. Genau, weiter geht's am 8. Jänner, diesmal wieder auf Deutsch, und es wird um sogenannte Conlangs gehen. Konstruierte Sprachen, künstliche Sprachen. Wie und zu welchem Zweck kreiert man eine solche künstliche Sprache? Neben berühmten Beispielen, Esperanto bis Klingonisch, wird es auch ein paar obskure Beispiele geben. Die Sendung erfreut sich der tatkräftigen Unterstützung von Super Science Me Collaborator und Universalgenie Daniel Siruvi. Wie immer auf der Welle 94.0, 8.1. um 18 Uhr und dann überall, wo ihr Podcasts hört. Julia Grinmeier sagt bye bye und guten Rutsch und bis bald bei Super Science Me.